From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. U.S. President Donald Trump used a rare executive power to declare a national emergency at the U.S. southern border in an attempt to secure funding for his controversial border wall. Former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe released a book that gives an inside look at the Trump administration-era Justice Department and exposes the extent to which the department felt that the incoming president was possibly a Russian asset. 2016 presidential candidate Bernie Sanders joined an already crowded ring for the 2020 presidential race, and MPs from both major British parties resigned in protest of current party leadership and policies, further muddying the political waters as Brexit looms just a few short weeks away. So, gentlemen, let's get started with the Trump declaration of a national emergency. A spending bill came back that led to us not having another government shutdown. Everyone was glad about that. There was also the very minimal funding for border security and for specifically a border wall. And the president took the option of declaring a national emergency as a way to get executive powers to bring funding into the wall. I'll start with you, Steve. Were you surprised by the fact that this happened, that he declared a national emergency?
No, I wasn't particularly surprised. I think he choreographed it pretty well. And he had been saying kind of up to it that he was not really impressed with the negotiations that were going on in Congress. He never gave the sense that he would be satisfied with some sort of compromise. So in some sense, really, he got to have his cake and eat it, too. He got over $1 billion from Congress for the wall. But now he's going to, with his emergency declaration, try to get more funding. So they are able to start with 55 miles of barrier, and he will try to use both the funds he's seeking through this emergency action, as well as he's repositioning some other funds meant to fight against drug abuse also in support of the barrier. So really, he's taken kind of all the sort of possibilities and thrown them all out there to build this wall that he promised as a campaign.
Tom, I always call you a resident historian, and I'm going to stick with that moniker. I did a little research leading into this and found out that there were, I believe, 31 current national emergencies that we're sitting under now. President Trump, in his announcement of this particular move, almost verbatim admitted that there is no national emergency here. Is there a national emergency?
It depends on what you think about President Trump, I guess, Michael. The bottom line is about two-thirds of the country believes that there is not a national emergency. The president is insisting that there is one. And Congress didn't believe there was one. As a matter of fact, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell several times said to the president, "Mr. President, don't do this. This will set a terrible precedent." Everyone except a couple of his senior aides said, "Let's do it." When I say senior aides, I mean Sean Hannity of Fox News, who may be
the conservative commentators.
Exactly right, who probably is his closest domestic advisor. Anyway, in the end, Senator McConnell looked terrible because to get the deal with the president, he had to agree that he would support this when the Democrats try to pass a resolution of disapproval. And McConnell has said, "I hated to do that, but it's the only thing I could do to convince the president to sign it, because if the president didn't sign the lesser bill, we'd have another government shutdown, which would be a catastrophe for everybody, including a human catastrophe."
Yes.
So I don't think there's a real national emergency. It doesn't really matter what I think, but most of the country doesn't believe so. And of course, he will not be able to spend more than the $1.3 billion he did get from Congress without a court fight. 17 states have already sued him, calling this unconstitutional. It will certainly go to the Supreme Court, and President Trump is hoping that the last two appointments to the court, both by him, very conservative, will provide the votes to get him to win this fight, but we will see, and it'll be weeks or months.
I'll go back to you, Steve. People often are amazed by the fact that President Trump doesn't form his policy in a way that chases 50% of the electorate. He's chasing 33% his base, but it seems to me that the number he's always chasing is 270, which is the electoral votes that it would take to win re-election for him. We've gone over the policy, and I think that the polls say that the majority of Americans think it's bad policy. Is it good politics to declare this and maintain this emergency and maintain the position that this wall must be built by any means necessary?
Well, it's not terrible politics. Let's put it that way. I don't think it's great politics. There's no evidence yet that Trump has been able to win over the independents that have abandoned him. He's certainly not winning over Democrats who don't support him at all. All that said, at this point, it is consistent with his 2020 strategy. Keep the base alongside, and at the end, he's going to try to attack his opponent, whoever that is, and try to make his opponent unelectable. So to do that, though, he has to carry that base. That base is pretty upset with his handling. They thought that he caved in. And although he did get criticized by some on the right, notably the conservative commentator Ann Coulter, by and large, they are still with him. Certainly the Republicans in Congress are still with him. So we haven't yet really seen sort of the second part of the Trump strategy, how he's really going to successfully convince a majority of Americans to support him. But in the meantime, he is still keeping that base pretty happy, and they are still with him.
Tom, I'm going to let you have the last word on this, and I want to go back to the institution. You've seen this institution of government, the institution of the Senate, of Congress, of the White House, and how it's evolved over the years. Is it a damaging thing to have these types of moves made that further consolidate power within the White House, within the executive branch?
Historically, absolutely. Yes, Michael. I mean, there has been a fight for years about expanding the power of the executive. I think most notably under Vice President Dick Cheney, whose view seemed to be more or less that if a president decides something, it's got to be true, or it can't be illegal because the president has superpowers under the Constitution.
Right.
Well, others, including scores of Republicans over the years, have argued just the opposite, that presidents do not have the power to override Congress, except in certain cases, and the presidents cannot spend money that Congress doesn't allow them to spend. And that's going to be the interesting thing when this gets to the Supreme Court. This is the first instance where a president has said, I have the power to spend money that Congress has said, no, you can't spend. So that is a constitutional clash, and that will be interesting to see what happens.
I think I'll give myself the last word and say that you know, it's the hardest thing to avoid, I always say, as an adult, is hypocrisy. When I look at how some were balking so vehemently at the executive orders that were given by Barack Obama, and you see the response to this, it seems that hypocrisy, again, is the hardest thing to avoid. Let's move forward and talk a little bit about former FBI Director Andrew McCabe and his book. I believe it's called The Threat, and in it there's some stunning revelations. Steve, we'll start with you. Your thoughts on this book, and what were some of the passages that struck you as the most surprising or most damaging, if you will, for the Trump administration?
Well, the fact that he came out in an interview this week and said it's a possibility that Trump is a Russian agent, I think was the one takeaway for me that even in this day still was a little bit of a surprise. You know, we've been sort of dealing with the fallout from the allegations of Russian collusion for the last 2 years. So if you took what McCabe, how he described President Trump, if you were new to this for the first time, I think it'd be incredibly shocking. I don't get the sense that Washington was shocked by what
it's hard
McCabe's
to be shocked anymore.
Yeah.
After 2 years. You're right. We're collectively that frog in the pot, as they say.
Right. What it really does is it helps set the stage for what we think will be an imminent conclusion, that it does seem that the Mueller report, the report from the special counsel, will be coming soon. I mean, we've heard that before, but especially with a new attorney general, it really seems like it's about to come. And I think everybody's really now waiting for Mueller. And one, whether we even see this report, I think we probably will, at least most of it. You know, it's sort of time for an official verdict one way or the other, whether he did or not.
It's been a while, and there's been some reporting about that report being imminent, but we've heard that before. So we'll take a wait-and-see attitude on that one, at least as far as when it actually is reported out of Mueller's office. Tom, I'm going to ask you two questions. What were the most sort of striking moments for you? And I want to ask you also if the Trump administration can actually make hay out of this book and turn it into a win for them by having it be a justification for the deep state claim that's always being made that there's a conspiracy to damage and control this president.
This so-called deep state theory is a linchpin, a centerpiece of the far right of the Republican right. They believe this. They take this as the Holy Grail. I think this works only for the 35% of the country who believe anything the president says and support him on anything he does. I don't think more than that base, and that's a considerable size base.
Yeah.
I don't think it resonates with anybody beyond that. Now, as to what struck me, I was really struck by McCabe's assertion that after the FBI opened an investigation to see if there was something involving candidate Trump and President Trump and the Russians, McCabe said that he briefed the congressional leadership, bipartisan, the House Speaker, the House Majority and Minority Leaders, the Senate Majority and Minority Leaders, and the ranking members of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, and nobody objected. Not even the, according to McCabe, not even the Republican members of the congressional leadership pushed back on that. And that, I think, was, to me, was quietly significant.
Yeah, I think one of the most stunning things for me was the fact that there was consideration of an FBI agent going into the White House, into the Oval Office, wearing a wire for a criminal-type investigation. The idea that that was even considered for the president of the United States was kind of shocking for me. And not to sell books for Andrew McCabe, but the other thing, if anybody wants to read that, is sort of the revelations about Jeff Sessions and his behavior when he was the Attorney General of the United States. It really sort of peels the layers off the onion for that particular guy. And I'll leave those who are listening to read that. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you'd like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for Market Watch. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome back. The Democratic field for presidential candidates just got more crowded, and it's going to continue to get more crowded. But two very significant individuals joined the race this past week. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, declared his candidacy for the Democratic nomination. We'll go over that, the interesting nuance there. And also Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota declared her candidacy. I'm going to start with you, Tom. Talk a little about Bernie Sanders. I think a lot of us know, but also I want you to talk about Amy Klobuchar. Who is Amy for those who don't know her? Senator Klobuchar.
Amy Klobuchar is the senior senator from Minnesota. I knew her father well. Her father was a famous sports columnist for the Minneapolis Star when I was a very young reporter there. She is a what I call a moderate liberal. There was a rating I saw recently, actually mentioned by the columnist George Will, a Republican columnist, who said Amy Klobuchar is listed as the 27th most liberal senator. Well, meaning she's in the mainstream of liberalism, and so she's not a liberal that scares the you-know-what out of people like Senator Kamala Harris or maybe even Bernie Sanders. And
so her, the view is Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth Warren, for sure. And so I think she could be an interesting candidate. However, Bernie Sanders, you get the feeling that Bernie's time was last time. There are so many more liberal, literally more liberal Democrats running this time than Sanders, that while he is a galvanizing force, he raised $6 million the day after he announced, so he can't be taken lightly. I get the feeling that he will not be the Democratic nominee.
I'll just go to Steve for you. I'll leave what I think for the end. But your thoughts on Bernie Sanders and Senator Klobuchar as well.
Yeah, well, real quickly on Klobuchar, the one thing I thought was fascinating, she's the first Democratic candidate I've heard this cycle actually say no to something. She was asked about whether she supports free college, and she says, actually, no, I don't.
Which is one of the major planks of the Sanders campaign, free 4-year college for all.
Yeah. So, again, which puts her into this moderate Democrat camp, which at the moment makes her kind of unique, although there still could be plenty of other candidates, and notably Vice President Joe Biden, who could still declare. I give the Bernie Sanders possibility, you know, I do think he has a possibility. And one thing he said that I thought was pretty interesting, he's like, you know, this time around, I could probably win with 30% of the vote because it's so crowded. And I'm not sure how this is going to play out. And this time around, not only will it be crowded, it'll remind us of the Republican 2016 battle. It's also shaped differently with California playing a much more prominent role, and obviously Kamala Harris, who's the senator from California, having a big advantage. But I think Sanders is a big player. He's already either number two or number three behind Biden in terms of popularity for Democrats. And he's a well-known person at this point. So I think he has a chance. I think this, I have no idea really how it's all going to play out.
No, we don't, do we?
And, you know, with the one thing that we learned from the Republican 2016 primary is if you can have a loyal base, you can make it far in these battles. And Sanders has a loyal base. Again, we saw it with the fundraising. That's why I do think he has a real chance.
It also helps, Michael, that he's going to be strong in some of the early primaries, notably the New Hampshire primary, which I think is first or second. I think it comes right after Iowa in less than a year, believe it or not.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there's a little bit of a front-loading advantage that will help Sanders in places like New Hampshire, which is always helpful.
And in his territory, in his part of the world where he is from. Right. So you have Joe Biden yet to announce formally. You have Beto O'Rourke, who lost his Senate campaign in Texas, but demonstrated a lot of charisma and a lot of ability to fundraise. So two heavy hitters have still not gotten into this race. It's going to be easy for people to get in. I think there's a number of other people who are still going to get into this race. Easy to get in. You just mentioned one of the factors, which is timing in the first two states, Iowa and New Hampshire. What are going to be some of the key factors that help people get out of this race? Because if people stay in for extended periods of time, it's going to actually help the other party as they beat each other up.
Well, the general rule on these kind of primary situations, Michael, is if you don't come in third or fourth at best in the first half dozen primaries, you have no momentum and you'll have to get out because the money will dry up. So that's why Sanders will be helped by the reality of New Hampshire coming early. A lot of liberals among Iowa Democrats, that might help him as well, even though it's a conservative state. And so you're not going to be able to come in fifth or sixth and stay in the race. I think there's going to be some weeding out among what I would call the Class B of the Democratic hopefuls.
Steve, I'll take the same question to you. What do you think is going to be the number one factor in having people be sort of filtered out of this crowded field?
You have to talk about money, you know, if it dries up and really being able. One thing that's interesting that's developed over the last 4 years is this ability to fundraise with small donations and to do it in a sizable way. And that's actually one of the key things. And you mentioned Beto O'Rourke, whether he could take that success in Texas against, you know, Ted Cruz, to be fair, somebody that was very easy for Democrats to rail against. So I do think the finances will be important. But also they have to craft a message that sells. I don't think enough of this field right now have a distinct message. And so that's one thing Sanders has. He has a distinct message. You kind of know what you get from Bernie Sanders. How many of these other candidates will have that distinct message?
Yeah, I think as I look at the field and I look at the prospects for them, I think there's an argument to be made that Bernie Sanders lost the primary last year. He lost the election, but he may have won the party because you see so much of the current direction of the Democratic Party based on the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Right. On the other hand, Michael, I think the party, the Democrats, were salivating at the prospect of getting rid of President Trump. And so I think these candidates are going to have to prove early on that they are the one, the chosen one who can beat President Trump. And two-thirds of the Democrats who have already announced, I think, have no chance of beating Trump. So we'll see how the contenders early on in the process set themselves up to make the case that I and I alone can beat Trump.
Yeah, I hear the word tossed around, electability. And right. What does that actually mean? And everybody wants to say, well, he's electable, she's electable, he isn't, she isn't. But to me, what I'm really looking for is someone, and in any party, not declaring that I'm for any candidate in any party, but what I look for in a politician is someone who not only has passion, I think you see a lot of passion in this current group of candidates, but I also want the power of persuasion, who can actually change someone's mind with a reasonable argument, with a reasonable intellect. And when you get that combination together, I think that's where you really have magic. Only a couple names come to mind when I think about recent politicians, but that in particular is what I'm looking for. Let's move on to our final topic, which is ministers of parliament resigning. As Brexit approaches, you get 7 members of parliament, I should say, have resigned from the Labour Party in protest to Jeremy Corbyn's approach to Brexit and his anti-Semitism. You had on the other side 3 conservative MPs who quit the party to join an independent group, which deals a blow to Theresa May's attempts to cobble together some sort of agreement for Brexit. She did not have a majority already and is losing members. Steve, I'll go to you. Is it possible that British politics should be more in chaos than American politics? I didn't think that was possible, but it seems so.
It absolutely seems so. And right now, what you're seeing with Brexit really in particular, I do wonder in a post-Brexit world if they'll also have these troubles. But right now, there isn't a majority for really anything in the UK Parliament. And you see that with the sort of the different negotiations with Brexit, and it's not really worth going into the vagaries of policy on Northern Ireland and tariffs and things like that. But basically, even within the ruling Conservative Party, there's no majority really for any clear action. The Labour Party, which you would think would benefit very easily, they're very divided over the issues you've talked about, and really the fact that you had a very left-leaning group kind of take over from more the centrist or what they derisively call the Blairite types of the Labour Party. So you have both of the major parties divided, and now you're seeing possibly a transformation of this still small but growing independent group that they're called, which is easy to remember. So there is chaos. Nobody really knows what's going to happen, and it's coming at a very important time. March 29th is the deadline for the UK to come to terms with leaving the European Union. And there's in danger of what's called a hard Brexit.
Which was almost certainly going to happen at this point because there is no agreement. And as you say, there's no majorities. There's no way to get a vote on anything other than a hard Brexit at this point, which still has to be approved by the European Parliament in order to be enacted. So I think that a hard Brexit is kind of a given. I'm going to give the last word to you again on this one. Tom, as we look at the two party leaders, and we have Jeremy Corbyn on one side, you have Theresa May on the other side. Two questions I want to ask you in our last 2 minutes. Can either one of those leaders survive as leaders of their party? And is a second referendum really the only solution to this problem?
Well, it would not be a good solution, but it might come to that. But your first question, Michael, I don't think either May or Corbyn can survive long term. I mean, I think they're both headed for the exits. I mean, the other thing that is interesting to me about all of this is while the political systems are very different, there is one similarity, it seems to me, between the U.S. system and the British system, and that is just as in the U.S. and in Britain, the conservatives are becoming, the Republicans are becoming more conservative, and the Democrats are becoming more liberal. And it's when that happens, and it's happening in Britain, it's harder to reach a consensus, especially on issues as profound as Brexit. So chaos is an understatement and is a charitable construction, Michael.
Yeah, I think that we'll all be watching that one very closely as March 29th looms on the horizon. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for Market Watch. This program is produced by Patrice Martin. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.